was a great spiritual writer who said that, then tonight I would like to have a shot at spirituality by beginning by making a confession. And the confession is that I am a devout Catholic, and I practice my religion fervently. If you look at the Royal Order of the Chicken, you will find that I am a charter member, and I've been that for a long time. It shows up in all kinds of ways. For example, I have been preaching at Dallas Seminary for about 12 or 13 years now, and I've been doing it for, I suppose, 30 years, but I seldom, if ever, get up in front of an audience to speak that I do not feel the butterflies fluttering in my stomach, seeming like they're battling, trying to get out. There is always that uneasiness, and I suppose it's because of my devout cowardice. I had the same problem, however, when I was in seminary, and I decided that I would earn a living for our family selling Watkins products. We almost starved to death. Not because Watkins products are not good products, but because I was a poor salesman. I would screw up all the courage that I had inside of me to sell that pepper or that vanilla to the lady in the next house. But by the time I knocked at the door and she'd answered it, I was almost saying to her, you don't want to buy any of this stuff, do you? And she usually didn't. That just created our problem. So I know that when it comes to this matter of evangelism, that I share some ground with some of you. I'm sure that many of you have absolutely no problem speaking to your friends about Christ. But if you do not get uptight about it, you have a normal, natural rapport with people, and I must say I envy you. But again, those of us who are members of the Order of the Chicken often have problems with it. Because you discover that you're afraid. Afraid of all kinds of things. Afraid, for example, that you're going to offend your friends. And then after you hear a sermon on not being ashamed of the gospel of Christ, afraid that you're not going to offend your friends because you're really faithful, you're going to just knock them over. Or afraid that you'll not know the answers when they ask you questions. Or afraid that if you do know the answers and you're able to give them the gospel, they'll say no and you'll be rejected. Or even worse, they'll say yes and you'll wonder what to do with them. So that when it's all said and done, you have all kinds of fears that keep you from sharing your faith with folks around you that you want to help. Now, if I'm not speaking to your condition tonight, you'll forgive me. As I say, this is my confession and it's good for my soul and it's not good for yours. But one of the problems that I had when I came back to seminary was that I was invited by students on the campus to speak at a number of the fraternity and sorority houses. And I found that a bit threatening. I imagined that it was one thing to talk to folks in church or talk to people on the street or people in their homes, but to go into the university and talk to the intellectually elite and present Christ to them, I imagined that they were going to come back with all kinds of questions. That I would have needed 3 PhD degrees and the knowledge of about 10,000 books to be able to handle their questions. And at that moment in my life, Paul Little of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship came through town, and I was making that confession to him that I'm making to you tonight. I told him that I was scared stiff, but I was going to go and do it, but I didn't know what would happen. And he said to me, well, what are you worried about? And I said, well, I'm not worried about the presentation. I'm worried about the questions. I have no idea what they're going to ask. They go, you don't have to worry about that. You can predict with great accuracy the kinds of questions that will be asked you. And I thought he was trying to give me some false courage. And I go, what do you mean you can predict the questions? He said, I've done it all for years now. He said, really, there's only 7 or 8 questions that you get again and again. So he sat down there in the campus of Dallas Seminary and spelled out for me 6 or 7 questions. Repeated again and again. You'll find those questions, by the way, in his book, How to Give Away Your Faith. And I discovered he is absolutely right. But you can anticipate the questions that you will be asked. In fact, I've often felt that this is one of the things that does reduce the fear of witnessing. I work with the Christian Medical Society, and sometimes when I go to another city, I'm asked to speak to a group of students. And you get off the plane and somebody says, boy, they're waiting for you tonight. You've got a bunch of guys there out to have your head. I've never understood how you get courage in a situation like that. You know, I guess, you know, you just call out to the Lord and have at it. But again, being a chicken, I find that I, if they want to call the whole thing off, it's just great. But they never call it off. In you go. But I discover even then, you get the same question given to you over and over again. In fact, I think that there's an analogy here when you go, when you teach at a seminary. Since I have some of my students in the audience tonight, there's no need for me to lie to you because they would know the truth. But I give horrible examples. I mean, I give what I think are simple questions, and it makes grown men weep. really, it's the simplicity that astounds the wise men in the class. There are men who write me poison pen notes and pin them on my door or call me in the middle of the night. I've lost more friends over my exams than anything else I do. So I say to the men in class, look, I'll tell you what. I'll give you an exam you can take home. That is, I'll give you the question, you answer it at home. And then I say to them, now you understand, if you take the exam home, it's going to be a lot tougher than if you take it here in class. Because after all, if you've got all your books at home and everything else, I can really put the screws on. So we'll take a vote. How many do you want to take home exam? How many do you want an exam here in class? Knowing that the exam at home will be tougher. Without exception, the class votes 90 to 95% to have a take-home exam. If I just know the questions, I don't care how much work it takes to answer them. The student feels secure and safe, and I guess some of the tension of the exam is gone. So it seems to me that one of the things that would be of help to us tonight would be to take a look at the questions that you will be asked if you do evangelism. I think you can reduce them to 8 questions. In fact, I'll go a step beyond that. I will guarantee you that 90% of the questions that you will be asked by non-Christians will fall within these 8 questions. And I can't tell you about the 10th question. That may be, you know, a curveball. But at least 9 out of 10 will be the questions that you'll get again and again and again. And maybe that will reduce the tension. Maybe you will feel more secure. Now, I could stand up here and give you the questions and the answers, but I decided that in the best tradition of teaching, that I would mimeograph the answers for you. I hope that when a person asks you the question, you don't take out the mimeograph sheet and say, but at least, you know, you will have it in front of you as I am talking. So let's distribute those folders back there, and we'll have a look at some of the common questions that people ask, and perhaps some direction as to how we can answer the question. Nothing else, you have a nice bright folder to take home as a result of this session to show folks who've been here. That's the way you feel when they ask the 10 questions. Oh, we have some others back there. All right, now, the objective to what we're doing is stated at the top of the yellow page. And I think it's important to at least lay the objective down, and that is to see if we can face and discuss briefly the common questions that non-Christians ask, and then to see if we can get at the issue in the question and to suggest some concrete answers that will focus on the gospel. Now, I do not pretend that I have given you the answers to all of these questions in depth. All I am attempting to do is to say, this is how you might handle the question when you're talking to somebody about the gospel to answer the question he asks, and then to come back and focus on the issue again. So the real question is, how do you handle these in an evangelistic discussion? By the way, just in passing, it's important for me to underline that these are the questions that non-Christians ask. I am convinced that if you were to ask this group of people to raise the questions they think non-Christians ask, we would have a whole bunch of other questions that seldom have ever come up. I think you will find that these come from non-Christians, and not from Christians who are trying to think like non-Christians. That's a whole other breed of cat. Like, the first question that you get after you have presented the gospel is, what about the heathen who have never heard about Jesus Christ? I suppose that's number one because it comes up most often. It's astounding, the missionary concern that non-Christians have after you've given the gospel. A deep concern for the people in Africa or Asia or Tibet. So what about the heathen who have never heard about Jesus Christ? If, after all, you are telling folks that Christ is the answer to the problem, then what about the people who have never heard? So basically, the problem that they're raising is, how can God be judged and condemn people who have not had the opportunity to trust in Jesus Christ? That's really what they're asking. And the basic answer, I find, is a help, takes this form. The first thing I usually say is that the Bible does not speak directly to this point. That is, I do not know a passage that tells us directly what happens to the heathen. I think that sometimes alleviates a bit of the tension. But then I go on to say, but one thing the Bible does tell us is that God is just. If you're concerned about the justice of God, you don't have to be concerned about it. Because if there is one affirmation that the Bible makes, is that God is indeed just and fair. And a second possible direction to take is that the Bible indicates that if a man will respond to the light he has been given, he will find God. I take it that in Romans chapter 1 and in John chapter 1, we are told that creation has given men a revelation of God and of God's existence and God's power. And if a man were to respond to that revelation and see the truth, that God would give to that man who responded to that light further truth. It may be intimated in Matthew chapter 7, where it says, knock and it will be open to you, seek and you will find. But I think the clearest example of this is in Acts chapter 10, in the story of Cornelius. Cornelius was called a devout man, a man of prayer, a man who gave alms, and he was a man who, under the guidance of the Spirit, I'm sure, was seeking God. And remember, God sent Peter to Cornelius to give him the gospel. Now, what I'm saying to people then is that if a man really does respond to the light that he has, if he really does want to know God, that God will see to it that he gets the light that he needs. A third thing that's important to say is that a man is condemned not because he rejects Jesus Christ, but because he has not lived up to his own moral standing. Now, this is a crucial thing in our day. When folks, I remember when I was taking sociology, my master's work at SMU, I had a professor who told me that the people in North Africa, really, it did not disturb them at all to rob. They thought that robbing was splendid. They would get on the ships and rob the tourists, and they seemed to be no conscience about it at all. The only question I asked was, well, I understand how they feel when they rob other people. My question is, how do they feel when people rob them? They get uptight if I steal from them. That indicates, doesn't it, that they have a standard that says, you shall not steal from me. But the standard of not stealing is written on their heart. The fact that they easily steal from others makes no difference. They do have a standard. And Paul's point in Romans chapter 2 is that every man has a conscience. A man may read in the paper about somebody who has lied in government, in politics, and say, that's wrong, you should not have done that. But if he turns around and lies, the standard, thou shalt not lie, has been applied to other people. And God says that he shall apply that standard to the man. You have a standard. A standard by which you judge others. All of us have a standard. And it is that standard that God would use to condemn men. So that whether they've ever read the Bible, whether they have ever seen the Ten Commandments, whether they've ever looked at the Sermon on the Mount. Every man has a standard by which he lives, by which he evaluates and judges others, and God will use that standard to judge the man. And the fourth thing is that there's no indication in the Bible that a man can be saved apart from Jesus Christ. John 14:6, Acts 4:12, say this very clearly. But coming back to point five, and this is what I mean by turning it to evangelistic advantage. If it is true that God will judge a person on the basis of the light that he has, then if you have heard of Jesus Christ and his saving work, then you are faced with the question of what you will do with him. Granting you may have problems with the people in Africa who have never heard, we are talking about their responding to the light they have. But we've presented the gospel to you, and the light you have is the light that is revealed in Jesus Christ. You know the issue. And when you stand before God, God will not hold you responsible for the heathen. But he will hold you responsible for you. So what do you do with the light you have been given? Because that's the more important question than worrying about the folks who have not heard the gospel in other places. At any rate, that's the first question that comes up. What about the heathen who have never heard about Jesus Christ? The second question that comes up is, what about the sincere Muslim and Buddhist and so forth? And here, the problem behind that question is that the Christian is a bigot for asserting that Jesus is the only way to God. Basic to that question is that one way is as good as another, provided that you're sincere. And how is it that we insist on being exclusive? Now, I think here what you're dealing with when that question is raised is the country club mentality. The average person looks at becoming a Christian somewhat the same way he looks at joining a country club. Back up in the Northeast, there were country clubs that were run by Jews, and they didn't want any Gentiles in. And in other parts of the country, there are country clubs that are run by whites, they don't want any blacks in. Now, obviously, if the board meets and decides, look, we've got to let the Gentiles in, or we've got to have some blacks in the country club, you can change the club rules. You can let in anybody you want to let in. So when a Christian says Jesus Christ is the only way to God, it sounds like he's being a snob. He's being a bigot. That he is saying, we want the club rules to be so stiff that only people who agree with us can get in. But the point is that in answering this question, a person needs to know that we are not dealing with preference. At the heart of the Christian claim, there is truth. For example, if I say to somebody, Nixon is the president of the United States, somebody says to me, yeah, but there are a lot of other nice guys running around. And I don't see, why you have to insist that Nixon is the president. So I'm not talking about whether they're nice or not nice. There's a truth. Is Nixon the president or is he not the president? It doesn't have anything to do with whether you like him as the president, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. That's just a statement of fact. And at the heart of the Christian claim, there is truth. So the first thing is that we are dealing with truth and not with preference. And I think that's an important thing to say. Another ramification of that is that the term Christian is often a synonym for the term gentleman. If you say, you're not a Christian, it almost sounds like you're saying you're not a gentleman. That, you beat your mother or you kick your wife or your dad's a relative or something. And to say that is obviously offensive. But the term Christian is not synonymous with gentleman. It's interesting, by the way, that the term gentleman originally was a term for a man who was one of the gentry, one of the noblemen who had been knighted by the king or the queen. So when you said that a man was a gentleman, you said that he had been knighted. That was a matter of fact, a matter of truth. But the man of gentry, the man who had been knighted, was supposed to act in a certain way. He put his coat down over muddy puddles so his wife could go across, and, did all kinds of nice things, had good manners. And then soon, the term gentleman, which once meant a man who had been knighted by the queen, began to refer to the manners of a man who had been knighted by the queen. So that today, in our country at least, the term gentleman has all to do with manners and nothing to do with being knighted. That's happened with Christianity. A Christian is a man who has a relationship with Jesus Christ, who believes certain things about Christ who appeared in history. Now, that Christian is supposed to behave in a certain way. He is to be truthful, he is to be kind, he is to have all of these virtues. Pretty soon, the term Christian in our culture has all to do with the virtues and nothing to do with the content. So when you say to a man, you're not a Christian, it often sounds to him like you're saying, you're immoral, you're a liar, you're a thief. I think it's important when a man raises this kind of a question to say to him, now, first of all, when we're talking about Christianity, we are talking about matters of truth and not about matters of manners. Now, the second thing then is that sincerity does not create truth or proof. And you know this to be true. Sincere grabbing of a bottle of poison instead of the bottle of medicine does not in any way change the nature of the poison. And behind this is often the idea that the Muslim is sincere, the Buddhist is sincere, but if we're really dealing with truth, sincerity does not change truth. You can sincerely believe a lie. You can sincerely believe what is wrong, and that doesn't change the issue in front of us. And third, Christians do not assert that Christ is the only way to God because they do not like other people with different views. This is what the historical records say about Jesus' claims about himself. Fourth, Christianity has things in common with other religions. That is, we have a moral code that is reflected in the moral code of some of these other religions. Our problem is not what they believe out on the circumference. Our problem is what they believe or do not believe in the center. At the heart of Christianity, there are claims about Jesus Christ that a man must say yes to or no to. And the claims that Jesus makes are exclusive claims. He says that he is the only way to God. If you reject that claim, you reject Christianity. If you accept that claim, you accept Christianity. But there's no way that he can be both the only way to God and a way to God. So, Christianity at its center has something other to say, different from other religions. And I have listed three things that are certainly unique. That is, that it's possible to have a personal relationship with a personal, infinite God. That is, other religions, the religions of the Greeks and the Romans, put an emphasis on personal God. The Muslims put an emphasis on an infinite God. But only Christianity and Judaism has a personal infinite God. A God who is infinity himself, but on the other side, a God who is able to relate to you in a personal way. Secondly, forgiveness of sins is often on the basis of the death of Christ. That's the only basis that the New Testament recognizes for the forgiveness of sins. That's an exclusive claim. And third, salvation is by God's overwhelming kindness, totally apart from human effort. Every other religion says, something in my hand I bring. Christianity says, nothing in my hand I bring. Right, five, fairness or justice implies that man has a claim on God merely because he is sincere. And what I'm attempting to say there is that often people use the term fairness or justice. And they use it in saying, if a person is sincere, then God is not just. If they reject Christ, then he is condemned. But justice is only justice when the person claiming justice has a claim on God. You see it, by the way, in the doctrine of election. People often reject the doctrine of election because it seems unfair, unjust, that God would save some and others would not be lost. But you will never understand the doctrine of election unless you understand that when God sees all men, he sees them as sinners who have no claim upon him. I have children. My children get things from me because they have a claim on me as my children. I buy my son a bicycle. The boy next door comes over. He says, look, I'd like you to buy me a bicycle, too. I said, sorry, son. Only for the kids in the family. No bike for you. The kid says, that's not fair. How come you don't buy one for me? And I said, well, no, it's no, it has nothing to do with fairness. You have no claim on this. Now, justice only operates where there is a claim on God. So that sincerity does not make a claim on God. A man cannot accuse God of being unjust if he has no claim to justice. All right, six, the question of fairness is not the only issue involved. There's the question of God's holiness, which only God can satisfy, which only Christ can satisfy. There's the question of man's inability to bridge the gulf to God by himself. All right, the third question is how can God allow suffering and pain to happen? And I must confess, of all of the questions, this is by far the most difficult. Not only difficult for us, it's difficult for anybody. There's the whole question of pain and suffering and evil. There's a question that cannot be handled with a flip response. But the problem is, of course, if God is loving, he cannot be all-powerful. If he's all-powerful, he cannot be loving, or else he would put an end to evil and suffering. The answer, it seems to me, is first of all, to admit that we don't have a complete answer to pain and evil in the universe. I think that that's the first thing you must do. But secondly, I think it's important to point out that evil came into the world, according to the book of Genesis, as a result of man's deliberate rebellion against God. And with evil came suffering. Much of the suffering that we see in the world is the result of evil. And man, as he operates, is responsible, relatively free. That is, he's not a robot. And wrong choices have their consequences. One of the illustrations that I find helpful here, perhaps would be helpful for you, is you remember the story of Pinocchio? As long as Giuseppe had a puppet, he had no problems. As long as he could operate that Pinocchio on his strings, you get Pinocchio to do anything you wanted. That is, there was no freedom involved. But when he turned Pinocchio into a boy, that's when Pinocchio was free to do his own thing. Remember, he rebelled against Giuseppe, and he got into all of the problems, and all of the pain, and all of the suffering that resulted when he became a little boy. In a sense, that is, is at least an aspect of what has happened to man. Man has sinned, and with the sin, there has come consequence. And if God were to wipe out sin, he were to suddenly decide at midnight tonight, all sin in the universe was going to be wiped out, so we'd stop suffering. He'd wipe all of us out, because all of us are sinners. It is part of the human condition, is sin. And the last thing, of course, is that God has acted to solve the problem of evil by allowing his son to die for man's sin. The crucial problem in the scripture is the problem of evil. And the problem of evil as it resides in an individual man. And God's solution to that problem is to allow his son to die for your sin, to solve for you for eternity this basic problem. Right, the fourth question, what about the conflict between science and Christianity? I find that this comes up in several different ways. The first aspect of the problem, I remember them here, is often when a person asks about the conflict between science and Christianity, what they are saying is that the only truth that is acceptable is that which is presented by science. That is, if it can't be measured in a test tube, they do not want to accept it. That's often behind the question. I think it's important to point out that there are a lot of different kinds of proof and evidence. One kind of evidence is what you get by repeating an experiment. But another kind of evidence you get is the evidence you get in the courtroom. And most of the decisions made in most courtrooms are based on testimony. Now, they are not based on verifiable evidence through the scientific method. But that evidence is valid for making decisions. So that the scientific method is based on report and control. But we do accept truth from other sources, such as history. And that's not scientific evidence. And there is reliable historical evidence for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. He has provided a way for men to become related to God. So that the evidence on which Christianity is based is not scientific evidence. But that does not make the evidence invalid. There is other evidence that we accept, on which we act, on which we make decisions, like history or testimony, that is basic to the operation of human life. A second problem is that science has shown that supernatural events of the Scripture can be explained on the basis of scientific principles. That is, when a person says, what about the conflict between science and Christianity, often that's what he means. I think one of the things that's important to say to people at this point is that merely giving an explanation for a phenomenon does not make it an accurate explanation. By that I mean, often people will explain away the miracle. And having given you an explanation, assume that that must now be accepted. For example, several years ago, criminologists explained evil by phrenology, by the studying of lumps on your head. And they felt that by examining lumps, they could tell something about the shape of your brain, and that they could predict whether or not you would be a criminal or not. Now, to my knowledge, there aren't too many criminologists examining bumps. But that was an explanation that seemed to explain why certain people were criminals. The fact that they gave the explanation does not make the explanation right. By second, the miracles in the Scripture are not only impressive because of what took place, but also when they took place. For example, people say, well, when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, a tremendous wind rose, and that opened up the sea, and they were able to go across. And they will show you in the Scriptures is what the passage says. And so they feel that they've walked away from the miracle, and they've explained it. But they've got another problem, and that is that if I'm standing here with the Egyptians behind me and the sea in front of me, and God uses a wind to open up a highway in front of them, the miracle is not only that it opened, the miracle is when it opened. And there is that side to the miracle that is not easily explained. And if you weigh the evidence, the facts support the claims of Jesus that he was God. That is, either he is a liar or a lunatic or a fraud. If you look at the evidence of the New Testament, the men who wrote these records saw him live, saw the things that he did, and they were convinced by what they saw, the signs they saw, that he was indeed God. Right? See, miracles are not scientifically possible. That's often the assertion made. There are no miracles. But this assertion obviously has a hidden presupposition. That is that God does not exist. Basic to that assertion is that there is no omnipotent God. And I have often said that if you can get past Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, you can get clear through Revelation. If once you believe that there is a God, then I see no real problem for God moving into history as he chooses to change events and to intervene in events if he chooses to do so. And Jesus Christ claimed to be God. If he is who he claimed to be, that is, if he is indeed God and there is a God, then miracles are possible. And we are really talking about a previous question, whether or not there is a God or not. And then the fourth, science contradicts what Christianity asserts to be true. And you get all sorts of specifics here. But I think one of the things we have to say is that science and Christianity have been in conflict throughout history. And both Christians and scientists have been wrong. Many, many times, what Christians have said, the Bible has said, the Bible didn't say. When we were at Illinois, one well-known radio Bible teacher had a series on why man will never reach the moon. I suspect that he has withdrawn the printed report of that series lately. But it was an 8 or 9 week series, supposedly based on the scriptures. And at the time, I remember saying to folks around me, I sure wish he wouldn't say that, because as soon as they plant somebody on the moon, folks will say, you see, the Bible's wrong again. The Bible wasn't wrong. The Bible teacher was wrong. Many times, Christians are guilty of saying what the Bible doesn't say. I think, by the way, we need to be careful of this in our time in the realm of prophecy. There are things taking place today that look like what the Bible says will take place. It's very easy in our proclamation of this to go to overcorrect and to make an equal sign where it does not exist. That is to say, what is taking place, for example, in the common market is the revival of the Roman Empire. That, I think, is just not warranted. That it looks like it, that it may be, that it could be, but that it is, that's something else. Because the doctrine of the second coming of Christ is that he may come any moment, but he might not come for 1,000 years. And the point I'm making here is that overclaim has been the thing that has hurt us. Secondly, some Christians have made the Bible say things it does not say. For example, to give an exact date of creation. The third thing is that sometimes it's helpful to say that Christianity and science basically, and I underline the word basically, deal with two different areas of truth. Science is primarily concerned with how, Christianity is concerned with why. I do not mean to imply that the Bible does not speak about scientific things, but I do mean to say that the writers of the scripture were not concerned with scientific terminology. Harry Emerson Fosdick, in his Modern Use of the Bible, makes a great case out of the fact that the Bible talks about the sun rising and the sun setting. And he goes on to say that obviously any man who knows science knows that that's not what happens. That it is not a matter of the sun rising and the sun setting, it's a matter of what the earth is doing. But when Harry Emerson Fosdick gets up in the morning, he will say to his wife, when did the sun rise? Or he'll say, look at the sunset. He's talking about the language of phenomena. Now, granted, he is not talking scientific language. And the Bible often doesn't talk scientific language. That's not its purpose. That's not to say that what it is saying is wrong or inaccurate. And then evolution claims creation by chance over a long period of time, whereas the Bible presents a 7-day creation. This usually goes, there's a lot of contradictions between the Bible and science. Oh, what did you have in mind? Evolution. Well, what do you mean? Well, evolution denies the Bible, or the Bible denies evolution. And in modern American education, evolution is accepted as an established fact. It's as sure in the minds of the average person going through a university that there was evolution as there is that there's a law of gravity. It's just, you know, it's an underlying assumption. Seldom ever taken out. Seldom proved, seldom looked at, but just assumed. So when the person comes back with that rejoinder, he feels he's got a trump card. Because everybody believes in evolution, and the Bible doesn't teach evolution, therefore it's wrong. Now, I find that in an evangelistic discussion, that the focus really ought not be on arguing evolution. I find that that just is not proper. I find that it is more profitable to say, now look, we've really got a question when we talk about evolution. And I don't particularly want to discuss the process or the evidence for it or against it. What I want to know is, behind evolution, what was there? Is God behind evolution? Or are you really telling me what a philosophic evolutionist says, and that is that time plus chance equals creation? Doing that, you're no longer on scientific ground, because time plus chance equals nothing. There is not a shred of evidence that if you take the parts of a watch and put it in a washing machine and give it 1,000 or 1,000,000 years, it'll ever form into a watch. time and chance just come out nothing. So that if that's what you're saying, you've got a whole previous problem to explain the universe. If you believe there is a God, then the question that we have to face is Jesus Christ is revelation. Rather than talk about how the world came, how God brought it about. And that's a valid discussion. If you grant that there is a God behind it, then the question before us is Jesus Christ his revelation? And we're back to the issue of the gospel again. All right, five, what do you do about the errors in the Bible? That is, how can we accept Christianity if the authority on which it is based has errors? The first thing I usually do is to ask the person what particular error he has in mind. That often kills the discussion, by the way. I discover that, some men can give you an intelligent response, but I don't supply any errors for them. I don't raise any questions. Usually I remember talking to a Jewish man a while ago in New York, and he said to me, I don't believe the Bible is filled with errors. That's interesting. What errors did you have in mind? Well, I don't know any, but everybody knows it's filled with errors. I said, well, you've just met a man who doesn't. Which one did you have in mind? Well, I don't know. Really, I'm giving the book a very honest chance. That's at least the place to start. Right? Then the second is that often, if they mean anything, they are saying that the text is filled with errors. That if errors have creeped into the text, as it's been transmitted over the centuries. That is, if you press them, one kind of error they bring up is, well, it's gone from generation to generation, it's 3,000 years old, and, as people were writing it down, it had all kinds of errors. The answer to that is that in the Old Testament, in the New Testament days, the task of a scribe was a highly skilled one. It was executed with the greatest of care. In fact, when the Masoretic text was written down, a man wrote down all the letters on a line and then went back and counted all the letters to be sure he hadn't added a letter. You get your secretary to do that, you'd have better letters written, all right? So it was a highly skilled task. And one evidence of this is that when the Old Testament Masoretic text, and the earliest text we had was 900 A.D., that is, the Old Testament text was a Masoretic text, but the earliest document we had that was still preserved was dated at 900 A.D. And then we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they are dated around 150, 100 B.C., depending on where you date it. But when they compared the document at 900 with a document that was 1,000 years earlier, they found that there was a remarkable correspondence. That is, they found that it was transmitted accurately. Every test we have of the text is that there has been accurate transmission. One Greek scholar says that only 1/1,000th part of the New Testament is affected by difference of the variant reading. There are variant readings, but only about 1/1,000th part is affected, and none of these deal with major doctrine. Now, what I have found helpful is point four. Especially this was true when I was at the university. I would have folks say to me, the Bible has a lot of errors. And I would say, what do you have in mind? And they may not have been clear. And I would give them a copy of the Gospel of John. And I'd say to them, look, I wish you'd read this for me. And all I ask you to do is to admit that the man who wrote that book was as honest as you are. I'll be glad for the purpose of our discussion to accept your presupposition. That is, that he made mistakes, that there were things that he may have missed. All I want you to do, for the sake of our reading, is for you to admit that he was as honest as you are. That he was not trying to perpetrate a fraud. Very few people would say that. Now read it with that in mind and tell me what you think. And if those come back having read the Gospel of John, or any of the other Gospels for that matter, and say, if only half of what this man writes is true, I've got serious problems. That is, the idea that you find one error, you have destroyed the force of the text is ridiculous. Here is a book that reports what Jesus said, what Jesus did. And a man does not have to believe in the inspiration of the Bible to read it and to be converted. If you will believe it to be reliable, if you will accept it to be the honest account of men who wrote what they witnessed, even though you want to grant everything, you still have a problem that these historians lived and talked and ate and witnessed what Jesus Christ did and saw him rise from the dead and went out and died for it. And that's pretty impressive evidence. So a man does not have to accept the doctrine of inspiration in order to see the force of the New Testament account. All right, the second problem that comes out of what about the errors in the Bible is how can we accept the record if it is not historically accurate? And there are two problems here. One is the problem of accuracy, and the other is the problem of transmission. The first says that the New Testament was wrong in what it taught about Christ. And the second is that the record was distorted by transmission, therefore cannot be trusted. Now, the accuracy of the New Testament teaching. You have 8 different eyewitnesses who attest to the life and death of Jesus in their writings. That's a lot of eyewitnesses. Now, these men were either lying or telling the truth. 10 of the original 12 disciples, according to secular history, died vicious and violent deaths because of what they believed. Some were boiled in oil. Some were crucified upside down, as was Peter. Some were stoned. Some were fed to lions. Now, they died for their faith. They died for the facts that they witnessed them. And that is pretty good evidence that they were not consciously lying. Because men will die for a lie. I mean, men will give a lie if knowing it's a lie, if it fills their pockets with gold. But men do not proclaim a lie knowing it's a lie. If every time they proclaim it, they're driving nails into their casket, or being thrown into prison, or being in danger of becoming martyrs. And then the accuracy of the New Testament, then there's no external evidence. The manuscripts were written by men other than those who claimed to write them. That is, sometimes people say, well, somebody else wrote it a long time later on. There isn't a shred of external evidence to support that. Right, 3, the accuracy of the New Testament transmission. There are more than 4,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. And the earliest complete manuscript goes back to about 300 A.D. Now, that may not be very impressive to you until you look at the history of Thucydides, who wrote 400 years before Christ. And all we have is 8 manuscripts. And the earliest manuscript that we have is 900 A.D. That is, compared to the doctrines of the documents of the New Testament, all of the ancient doctrines of ancient Greeks, of ancient Rome, are late. They are few. But nobody doubts that they are essentially what Aristotle wrote, or what Caesar's Gallic Wars were about. It's only when they get over into the New Testament that they become anxious because of the content of the New Testament. We have manuscript fragments of the New Testament that go back to about 100 to 200 A.D., and the Rylands fragment may actually go back earlier than that. And in terms of ancient literature, that is phenomenal. Allusions to and quotes from the New Testament are found in the writings of the Apostolic Fathers from 90 to 160 A.D. That is, the Fathers quote the New Testament, which indicates that they had a New Testament in their hands, which, again, puts the documents back into the first century. So if you're going to talk about reliability of the document, you just cannot compare the reliability of the New Testament document with any of the other documents. They are so far superior that there's just no comparison. Right, the sixth question is, if is not a good life enough to satisfy God? And the problem here may not be a rejection of the gospel, but sometimes it sounds as though Christians are saying that a good life is worthless. A couple of years ago now, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was invited to the home of a very wealthy man to talk to him about Christ. We had dinner together, and then after lunch, we went into his study, and we sat down. He said, all right, tell me about it. My son has become a Christian. I'm interested. Tell me about it. So I sat down for 30, 35 minutes, as best I could, laid out to him the gospel. When I was all through, he said to me, there's something about what you're saying that disturbs me. What was that? He said, well, look, I have been in the city all of my life, and he said, I have contributed a great deal to the city. I have been in charge of the community chest several times. He said, I have helped to build a hospital for crippled children. He said, I have tried as best I could to be a good citizen. He said, I realize that you may feel that I'm boasting when I say this, but I do not think that's the spirit of which I say it. He said, across the town, we've had red light districts. There are people over there who have lived in this city as long as I have, who, as far as I can tell, have contributed nothing to it. Everything they've done has been destructive. They have torn at its fiber and its fabric. And it seems to me that what you are saying is that I am no different from them, that we are both the same. He said, I first of all resent it, and secondly, he said, I think that's very stupid, because there is a difference among men. And he was right, wasn't he? Because that was a very telling objection. And I said to him, I obviously have not made myself clear. I want to apologize for that. Because it is obvious that this city is a better city because you have been here. In terms of the community, there is no doubt that you have contributed far more than many of your fellow citizens. And that this city is better off because you did this. I think the problem you're facing is that you feel that the differences that matter among men matter with God. And that's the problem. The real question is, if you stand before God, not how do you compare with the man in the red light district, but how do you compare with him? The second thing I said to him is this. The problem, you see, is not your goodness. The real problem is your sin. If I'm driving down the highway, and I go through a red light, and the man with the gumball machine on the top of the car pulls me over. Because he just ran the red light back there. It doesn't do me much good to say, I know that's true, officer, but did you notice that since I left home, I stopped at 7 other red lights? And I only run about 1 out of 7. And I wish you would really take into account that I, you know, I'm pretty good about stopping at red lights. And just now and then I go through. He said to me, look, the law isn't really concerned with how many lights you stopped at. What I'm concerned is about the one you went through. And that's the one the judge is going to talk to you about. It's not your goodness. The real question is your sin. And after I was through, he said to me, you're right. He said, you've made a telling point. He said, because I know that if I stand before God, that although these things may matter in the community and do, if I really stand before a holy God, I do have problems. I know myself. And that's the point that we're making here. The question is not about your goodness, but about your sin. And it's that which makes a man unacceptable to a holy God. And Jesus Christ died for our sins to enable us to stand forgiven. The seventh objection that you get is not Christianity only a psychological experience? That is, since Christian experience is psychological, then the reasoning is, it may be false, or it must be false. Now, how do you answer that? Especially in our day, for example, when you get some of the Jesus people, who evidently have come to faith in Christ, and there's been a great change in their lives. Not unusual to have people say to you, well, that's great stuff for them, but it's a psychological kick they're on. They've changed. Last month, Society Magazine has an article on the Jesus people, and the Sociological Magazine. And that's how they write the whole thing off. All right, so the question is, maybe the whole thing's psychological. And you have to respond that part of conversion is psychological. That is, it deals with the immaterial and non-material part of man. And usually it's explained as a kind of wish fulfillment. But one point I think is worth making is to those who insist that belief is due to wish fulfillment, infantile experience, the desire for security, It can also be shown, I think, that unbelief can be due to these same causes. Everybody can play this game, by the way, of psychoanalyzing the opponent. My experience is that when I talk to young people who say have grown up in the church, you know, turned off on God, the thing didn't really start with serious consideration of theology. It started because they're still mad at their parents. And because they got ticked off at their parents or the strictness of the home, they have decided that they're not going to have anything to do with it. Now, if you want infantile explanation for belief, you can get infantile explanation for unbelief. If you want wish fulfillment, I am sure that there are fellows on college campuses who are having a great time with the girls who would like to get rid of God. Because if they can just get rid of God, they can sort of enjoy themselves freely, they think. A man is getting rid of God. It's not because they sat down and really wrestled the theological issues through to the bitter end. Because God gets in their way. He spoils the fun. And so their atheism and unbelief is just as much a psychological thing as they might explain Christianity to them. So the question is not the motive for belief, but whether or not Jesus was in fact who he claimed to be. Men go into psychiatry. Some physicians go into it because they want to solve personal problems. That's the motive for getting into it. That does not, therefore, make psychiatry an invalid science. Sometimes that is said, you know, so-and-so went into psychiatry because he had his own personal problems to solve. And sometimes when a man says that, it almost sounds as though he's saying, therefore, psychiatry is invalid. The motive does not make it invalid. Why you go into psychiatry does not make psychiatry invalid. Why a person goes into Christianity does not make Christianity invalid. A man may turn to the Christian faith because he wants security. He may turn to the Christian faith because he wants to get out of the whole dope scene. He may turn to the Christian faith because he wants meaning and purpose to life. That motive does not in any way judge the truth of Christianity. The truth of Christianity is judged, as I have in point two under B, on objective history. That is, did Jesus Christ die? And did he rise again from the dead? Are we dealing with reliable doctrine? If that is true, if Christ really has risen from the dead, then why a person is drawn to Christ does not invalidate the objective truth of the Christian faith. So the question, could not conversion be wish, that should be wish for